Hello, my name is Michael, and you're listening to Forever Sound Version, a video game music podcast. Do, dear friends, and welcome to episode number 49 of this podcast, which is called Forever Sound Version, a video game music podcast. And today I am joined by a guest on this freakishly warm Sunday evening. I have Robert Hunter in the building. How are you doing, Rob?
Oh, I'm all right. I'm sweating. I probably shouldn't have walked here in all black.
Yeah, this is goth problems we're seeing right here. It is really, really warm. Comparable to when we had Chris Machel over, we had to have all the windows open and all you could hear were birds squawking into the house. Hopefully we'll have none of that today, but we'll see. So some listeners might remember Rob from the Master System Showcase.
Halloween.
And Halloween, the super scary, spooky, scary special episode. But this episode, your third appearance, this is something that you're going to be taking the lead on, for the most part, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I think I know the games a bit better, even though I'm a bit of a latecomer to them myself.
Right, well, I don't have very much experience of these at all. We're talking about LucasArts games. LucasArts games, so a lot of point-and-click adventure titles for the PC, is that right?
Yeah, mainly. Obviously they did the Star Wars licensed stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the adventure game series that we won't cover is the Indiana Jones one.
Right, like a separate license once again, right?
Yeah, but the core idea of what you think of as a LucasArts game, we just had Secret of Monkey Island.
That was the intro track.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, if you think first-person shooters and you think Doom, and you think platformers and you think Mario.
Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, this is like that title to them, and this publisher is kind of, there is one big rival that I might mention later because it's a game a bit like one of theirs, but LucasArts adventure games, the humour, the puzzles,
they kind of pioneered the genre, really.
Yeah,
that sounds about right. I mean, Secret of Monkey Island is one of the few games of this type that I've had any kind of sustained exposure to. It seems to be the big hit of the genre. Maybe
this wasn't my experience, but I think whenever you read anything about people's memory of it, it's like the one that they played at, like, it's like their uncle had it on their PC, on like their work PC in the home office.
It was the
and
one
it would have
fun
Monkey
thing.
Island on it, and that's what people pay. And like, when I say I came late, I played it for the first time on the reissue version on the Xbox 360.
Which is
probably
pretty late.
Not a system for this kind of game.
No. Did that control okay with that controller?
It had, well, the good thing about the remasters is you could play, you can flick between the original game and the remastered remake, and you had the two different control systems.
Okay, that's interesting.
And, I mean, the remake used the art style that from later in the series that I know a lot of people hate. The original one is like a proper 8-bit kind of vibe. And then it has these weird sort of portraits that are in incredible realistic detail, whereas the remake goes more cartoony for everything.
I see. I can see how that would rub some people up the wrong way.
And from controlling it, there's one puzzle that there is literally no way to finish it using the new control scheme. You have to change back.
You got to switch.
Yeah, because yeah, it's an inventory puzzle.
That's pretty awkward. Interesting mechanic there. I figure that one thing that most fans of the game would probably agree on is the music is pretty sharp. This is a piece that I am quite familiar with, this introduction track, composed by Michael Land and Patrick Mundy, as far as I can see. Those are the composers for this one. And I'm not really one to try and put the world into millions of boxes as far as music goes, but if I was to pin a style on this, the closest thing I can come to is prog reggae.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense? Yeah,
that does make sense. Well, the whole soundtrack's obviously like it's Caribbean islands.
Right.
And through the filter of being on early PCs and 8-bit systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it sounds to me anyway. So I haven't heard anything like it before or since. So.
And with these, you spend, like, so kind of being called adventure games comes from rather than being your old arcade titles where it's like, the objective was to, you know, shoot the thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, get as many points.
Yeah.
I mean, the adventure games and kind of text adventures would be the kind of precursor to them.
They're okay,
about
yeah.
building a world and building character in
sure.
a way that arcade titles didn't necessarily need, because they just, with those, you just sort of need it. This is the premise, here's the action.
Yeah, like very
Whereas
intuitive
with
controls.
These, you're spending a lot of time exploring a world and the character of the world, so I think music really matters in these, so that is, you know, suitably tropical.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds that like it's the composers had that in mind. And I think we'll hear from the other soundtracks we'll be addressing that music remained quite an important consideration throughout the LucasArts titles. I imagine that you've got some notes on LucasArts more generally, but I thought I would just run some basic facts through this show. Maybe you can embellish upon them. As you might expect, a company was founded by George Lucas of Star Wars fame in 1982, originally as Lucasfilm Games. Its first release was a game called Ball Blazer, which came out in 84 for pretty much all of the important 8-bit platforms of the time, so the ZX Spectrum, Commodore 64, MSX, NES, and so on. And by the mid to late 80s, LucasArts was releasing games on MS-DOS, which is a very important platform for these point-and-click adventure games. Much later on, company was acquired by Disney in 2012, as the parent company. Lucasfilm had been bought, I believe, around that time.
Yeah, they bought Lucasfilm, and I think they basically just got hold of LucasArts to squeeze out the last licenses and sort of copyright permissions.
Exactly, yeah.
The real acquisition was Star Wars, and Star Wars is owned by Lucasfilm.
Yeah, that's the big money spinner right there. So LucasArts is no longer a developer, it just kind of continues to, I mean, it's reissuing some of the titles, like remastering.
The reissues are by, there's sort of three or four sort of key guys who develop most of these games, and the reissues are coming from the studio that they sort of went on to found.
Right, okay.
Independently. And they've been sort of going back and acquiring their creator-owned games.
Oh, that's kind of nice they can do that, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite nice. All right, so anything else interesting about LucasArts? Because I'm kind of a novice when it comes to the history of these games.
I mean, well, one thing is, of the dozen or so games we've got here, they all are based on using the same gameplay engine.
Ah, you're talking about the Scum engine.
Yeah, which was developed for the game we're going to listen to next.
Yeah, right. So
they all just use iterations of it. So that's like 10 years where, I mean, they refine it, they tweak the graphics, the gameplay a little bit for each title. But they're all essentially the same game.
Getting a lot of mileage out of that system, right.
And it's the kind of classic, you know, the view of sort of two-thirds of the screen are the game, and the bottom third is the menu and the command prompts.
Right, like the sort of interface, if you
yeah.
like. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, from what I understand, some of the early titles, I think we're going to look at Maniac Mansion next, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, there's a couple of titles we've not looked at that I'm not so familiar with, but we've kept it to the sort of core.
Let's stick to the classics for this one, yeah, why not? Maniac Mansion was initially programmed using 6502 assembly language, but this turned out to be pretty limiting when it came to coding for scrolling, graphics, and using a player interface and all that. So the team devised this Scum. Am I saying, is it, just say Scum Engine, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, Scum with two M's.
The Pirate's Bar in Secret of Monkey Island is the Scum Bar.
Ah, smart.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that is throughout all of these titles, and they all jump into each other.
Like funny little references like that. Yeah. So it's a script creation utility for Maniac Mansion. So Scum is named after Maniac Mansion, right? And yes, of course, it was reused a bunch of times. Ten years, though. That really is a lot of mileage out of a single engine. I mean, maybe it's like the Quake engine or something.
Yeah, well, like all those games that were sort of made on Doom and stuff, that just lasted forever.
Yeah.
So I guess if Monkey Island's Doom, Maniac Mansion must be Wolfenstein. Here is everything that these titles can do, but we just haven't got it right yet.
Yeah, still fleshing it out.
Yeah,
that makes sense, like a nascent version. So we're going to hear, just for the sake of variety of music, right, we're going to hear an NES version.
Yeah.
So this game, Maniac Mansion, was ported to the NES, released by the company Jalico, and included music by a team called Real Time Associates, whose boss, David Warhol, got composers George Sanger and David Hayes to compose pieces that were specific to each of the game's characters. So it's, as far as I can tell, that's kind of like a Final Fantasy-style approach. Say Final Fantasy VI, Final Fantasy VII, where individual characters have their own kind of motif kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like that.
Yeah, there's a reason for it, but should we hear it and then...
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So which track are we going to have?
This is the Edison family theme, who are the residents of the Maniac Mansion.
All right. Edison family theme, composed by David Warhol. We just had Edison Family Theme from the NES port of Maniac Mansion, released in 1990, and that was translated into a chiptune composition by David Warhol. That's a kind of a bit of a rocker, that one, in a obtuse sort of way.
Yeah, I mean the game is sort of a parody of like your Freddy Krueger kind of 80s like comedy teen horror sort of movies, and that's why each character has their own theme, because they're the live system for the game. So you have a whole cast of characters, and as they're killed off one by one, you switch to the next one, and that one has his own or her own theme as they wander around the mansion.
Oh, that's interesting. So is it just purely a live system, or do the characters have any quirks to them?
I mean, gameplay-wise, just sort of, because in all these games, the classic sort of control panel for a scum game is that you can look, push, pull, pick up, interact. You know, that's how you interact with the items.
Fairly universal
stuff. So they make
fairly
different comments.
Yeah.
As we, you know, there's one who's a sort of classic 80s, like, Revenge of the Nerds looking nerd. Mm. So he'll say nerdy things. There's one with, like, a leather jacket and a quiff. So he'll say that, you know, cool guy kind of things.
Yeah, of course. A lot of wisecracking, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you get films like Lost Boys or whatever where, mm-hmm. you know, eventually they're going to take the fight to, you know, the villains, or like the villains make their comeback. So you get these kind of stings of like sort of, yeah, rock music, rock, like that film. There is actually one of those films which is about a rock star coming back from the dead, and Ozzy Osbourne's in it and Gene Simmons is in it, and he tries to kill people by playing a ridiculous guitar solo that can hypnotize them.
Oh,
like, these are the influences that would go into a game like that, and that's where you get that kind of like comedy and the rock music kind of edge to it.
Yeah, I've got time for that sort of thing, for sure.
But then again, process down into like NES mode.
In this case, yeah. Alright, how about we move on? Ooh, okay, this is a curious thing about this episode, because, like we alluded to, many of these LucasArts games, chiefly from the 90s here, have been remastered and reissued, and that means like new art and reimagined Red Book Audio soundtracks. So how about we get into one of those ones?
Yeah, this one is the direct sequel to Maniac Mansion.
Mm.
And when I was kind of thinking of what games we should include, I avoided most of the sequels, because all the Monkey Island games are very, you know, they're pretty similar.
Right.
The Sam & Max ones, which we'll get to later, their sequels were made by a different developer. They're a different type of game. But Daily Tentacle is, I mean, it has the reputation of being the best of all of these games.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's this or Monkey Island is the most iconic too, probably.
Okay.
So yeah, Daily Tentacle, the direct sequel to Maniac Mansion, where, having been a house with the crazy killer Edison family, it's now been converted to a motel. And our prime protagonists must go back to the mansion solve the mystery.
Maniac motel then, basically.
Yeah.
Smart. Okay, let's get into this one. We're going to have Back to the Mansion from the remastered version of Day of the Tentacle, and this was released in 2016. That was Back to the Mansion from Day of the Tentacle, the remastered version released in 2016, composed by Clint Barhakian? Barhakian? Let's go with that.
Yeah.
Clint Barhakian, Peter McConnell, and Michael Land. That's a different animal to what we had before.
Yeah, and I think, in my head, adventure games are, the 90s adventure games have something of like, you're like Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network shows from the mid-90s, like Rocko's Modern Life.
I know them well, yes.
That kind of show. In my head, that's the character of all of these games.
Mm.
Even though, really, it's probably only two or three of them. But I think that sort of music, and you've got that kind of like, you know, like Animaniacs and like that whole sort of strand of cartoons and
kind of like offbeat zaniness.
Yeah, where everything's, stuff just happens and there's, you know, in this game in particular, there'll be historical figures, or because in this one, a purple tentacle grows arms and takes over the world, and the three protagonists are split across time zones. So one of them's trapped with George Washington, one of them's trapped with Dr. Edison in the present day, and then one of them's sent to the future, which is ruled by the tentacles.
Okay.
But it's the same location, just in past, present, and future.
Interesting.
And the way they can, and that means they can throw things at you. Like in the future, there's human shows, so you've got to dress up in like, you know, ridiculous wigs and all that sort of thing. And the tentacles might have like there's one that is like a big game hunter. You know, it's got like a pith helmet and a big net and a mustache.
Oh wow!
You know, they're all the kind of things you would see in those kind of cartoons.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, the split level thing makes some of the puzzles even more baffling.
Yeah, I hear this one's got some particularly tricky puzzles in it.
Yeah, I mean the basic kind of puzzle for adventure games in general, if you don't know, would be like if our microphone broke here, and the fix would be get a pine cone and a car battery and a length of like wall that we tricked out of like an old lady's shopping basket, and somehow combining them would be the microphone substitute. And like I was saying off mic before, while you can see the logic at the end of the result, the process, you don't see what the entry point is, what the beginning to these puzzles would be.
Yeah, some kind of hardcore MacGyver situation.
Yeah.
Like, where do you start, though?
Well, like in Day of the Tentacle, there's one where you need to get some vinegar in the past. So in the 18th century, you need vinegar. And the way you get that vinegar is by getting a bottle of wine, putting it in a time capsule, burying it, swapping the plans for the United States to be tentacle shaped,
right,
so that the flag isn't rectangle anymore, it's tentacle shaped, and then send from the present day, I think it is, a can opener to the future. And then in the future, you have to climb the roof, get the flag, which is now a cone, wear the cone as a disguise, find the time capsule, use the tin opener on the time capsule to open it, and the wine that you put in the capsule in the 18th century is now vinegar, which you can now send back in time.
Yeah, I don't think too many people are going to be upset with you for revealing how to go about that puzzle, because that's brutal.
I'm
really hard.
Well, I'm in the middle of replaying it on the PS4, this reissue, and according to howlongtobeat.com, the game should be about 2.5 hours, 3 hours long.
Okay.
It took me about 3 hours to get to that point, like to get that last puzzle.
Sure.
And that is probably a third of the way in.
That's wild. This is why I never really got big into these games myself. Patience for the puzzling side of things. I can look at these games and really appreciate all the craft that's gone into them. I think they're brilliant to admire from a distance, but to play them, I'll be tearing my hair out, I think.
It's not on this list because it's not by LucasArts, but the Discworld game
with
Eric Idle.
Oh my god, yes.
It's kind of infamous for that.
Yeah.
Like, there's one where you need some gold to give to a dragon, and the solution involves putting an octopus in a toilet and then spiking someone's food so that when they run to use the toilet, the octopus grabs them. They get a big fright in the toilet and their belt buckle comes out at the bottom of the cubicle door, and the belt buckle's made of gold, and then you can give that buckle to the dragon.
Yeah, see, that's about as obtuse as it gets. I've given a couple of those Discworld. I mean, there's quite a few of them, right?
Yeah.
There's Discworld tiles. I've played one or two of them, and again, they look great, but
yeah, and they get
where to start.
Yeah, all of these games get their sort of characterization and their world building, and the humor and references are perfect.
Yeah.
And then you spend 40 minutes flicking between screens and locations, just going, I don't know what any of these items do, and there's nothing to, I don't see what they could possibly interact with.
Man. Yeah, right.
I don't know how anyone did them before, like, YouTube.
Yeah, just a lot of perseverance, I suppose. A lot of patience. And these days, I have neither of these things, as far as games go.
Yeah, I mean, I'd literally have a PhD, and it's taken me, what, And it's taken me the full expected playtime to get less than a third of the way into the game.
Yeah, maybe we're all just getting stupider because of instantaneous access to the internet, right? Maybe that there's something in it. Just getting, instant gratification or something like that. All right, well, this next game we have lined up, this looks very interesting. I had a little look online to check this one out. We're going with a game called Full Throttle, and I understand that this title made use of some professional actors for the characters' voices, including Mark Hamill. So there's a Lucas connection there, right?
Yeah. Day of the Tentacle was one of the first games to use a fully voiced cast.
Okay.
But then, obviously, the studio must have been proving itself worthy of something, because Full Throttle would have been in the next year of games, and it has, actors like Mark Hamill.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a get, I would have thought.
Yeah.
So this game also is one of the few LucasArts games to use some licensed music in addition to music that their composers produced. It has songs by a San Francisco area hard rock band called The Gone Jackals, who in my Wikipedia research I learned were active between 1984 and 1999. And this soundtrack got a lot of acclaim upon release. It's a bit of a heavy affair in a way, like a sort of a psychedelic rock sort of thing.
Yeah, we're in the indefinitely defined sometime near future, but biker gangs still roam the highways and deserts of America, of what's left of corporate America.
Oh yeah, fantastic. So I believe this track we're about to hear is indeed by that band, The Gone Jackals. We're going to hear On the Edge of the End from Full Throttle, released in 1995. We just had On the Edge of the End by a band called The Gone Jackals, and that was from the game Full Throttle. I'm hearing that, and in my mind's eye, I'm seeing snarling Marvel characters. I'm seeing, like, Wolverine's crazy eyes and gnashing teeth.
The hero of this game has, like, the squarest Desperate Dan sort of jaw and physique. Like,
oh, okay.
You know,
Desperate Dan,
like,
okay.
Huge, stubbled. Then, like, leather jacket and jeans and, you know, fingerless gloves.
Yeah.
Leader of a biker gang who's been wronged.
Oh, man. So this is, that's consistent with these big, chunky riffs, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so. And one thing, like, the clackers, like I was saying, the Scum Engine has your sort of classic interface of push-pull look.
Okay.
Pick up, interact with. That's changed for Full Throttle, where the commands are hand, foot, and mouth.
Ah.
So when there's an object or a person, you can click on them and it's use hand, use foot, or use mouth. Okay. And mouth might mean talk, it might mean, you know, take a drink of something. You know, use hand might mean pick up item or punch thing.
Ah.
You know, the same with kick, foot might mean climb up thing, or but they're context specific, so you just click use hand and this and your big meaty protagonist will just go over and
hand something.
and there's little kind of like Road Rash almost style, like arcade scenes that link them, like combat scenes, bike combat.
Okay. Oh, nice.
You know, that kind of like, you know, sliding from slide to slide to dodge obstacles, but also, you know, punch left, punch right.
Oh,
as people kind of jump in on you.
This might be the adventure game for me.
It's slight. I mean, the reason it can have that interface is because it's the least puzzly.
Oh,
probably of all
music
the games.
To my ears, and it's got some action elements.
Yeah,
and heavy
and
metal. Yeah, and riffs also. Yeah, this sounds like my sort of thing. Full Throttle, was this one reissued or remastered or anything
it
like that?
It has been, yeah. It's another Double Fine reissue where, you know, I mean, the thing about the Double Fine reissues, they've scaled up the graphics, so instead of kind of pixel art, they now look like cartoons.
Sure.
You know, smooth lines, you know, more animation frames.
Mm. Yeah, this one, I might have to check this out. Maybe get my PC gamer hat from out the dusty cupboard and give this one a try.
Yeah, I was half wondering when I was doing the research, because of when it comes out in the LucasArts cycle, it's coming towards when Phantom Menace would have been in development.
Mm.
And I know that later on, LucasArts stops producing so many original titles, and you get a few more Monkey Island sequels, and then they're pretty much, it's pretty much Star Wars games till the end.
And there are a lot of Star Wars games.
Yeah, so I kind of wonder if this game that's set in sort of a near future, and there's just a sort of corporate wasteland, and these are like the last outlaws.
Oh.
I wonder if there's like some subliminal...
Yeah.
Like, because Lucas, like reading up on LucasArts, Lucas was hands-off with them. He knew that games were a thing, and, you know, we wandered in on that.
Sure.
So that's why... But they were pretty much left to their own devices to kind of get on with making their own games. And it was only later on that they really lent on it with the Star Wars license. And, you know, eventually these games, as sort of different developers left, these original titles stopped coming out.
Yeah.
So I wonder, Full Throttle...
It's like one more like last hurrah sort of thing. Yeah.
If someone wants to... use hand, use foot. George Lucas.
Yeah, use mouth as well, of course. So what we got next? This is a title and a half.
This is a jump back. I mean, I thought it was from the 80s, but it's actually from the 1990.
Right.
But it definitely, for me, it's got more in character because it's from before Monkey Island, after Maniac Mansion. But I think it has more in common with the LucasArts big rival for adventure games is a company called Sierra.
I'm familiar with Sierra,
King's Quest and Space Quest and Police Quest.
A lot of quests.
Yeah. Well, and each of those have, I think there's about 10 King's Quest games.
Right.
You know, it's 5 or 6 Space Quest games. There's not as many Police Quest ones, but, you know, they all have their kind of mode. And there's similar sort of humour. They're slightly more serious in tone. You're more likely to die. But there's something about this title, which is Zach McCracken and the Alien Mindbenders.
Zach McCracken and the Alien Mindbenders.
Yeah, I mean, it's from the sort of tail end. Like, I think it did come out on Commodore and systems like that.
Mm.
And that sort of title puts me right in that era.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
And the sort of, the character of it is very much like that as well. You're a guy who works for a telephone company who finds out that aliens are trying to take over the world by buying the telephone company, so you set off to find a set of artifacts which you combine with another alien race to defeat them.
Huh. Okay. That's far-fetched indeed. Yeah.
And you sort of travel around the world, so it has quite a lot of more ambient music, but this is one of the snatches of something that is less so.
Yeah, right. And we're going to hear an FM Towns version of it as well.
Yeah.
So we're getting away from Redbook, getting away from PC once again. We're going back over to Japan. So what's the title? This is a strange title. What's that?
I'll have to see if I can pronounce it. Hang on.
Yeah.
I have notes. Inder Glop Order Krell.
Inder Glop Order Krell.
I imagine, given the kind of people who would have been programming these things and the era it's from,
yeah,
there's something of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Okay, that would make sense.
Going into this.
Yeah, that's possible. All right, well, let's have it then. The FM Towns version of Zach McCracken and the Alien Mindbenders, released in 1990. Inder Glop Order Krell, composed by Matthew Alan Kane. Inder Glop Order Krell from Zach McCracken and the Alien Mindbenders, the FM Towns version. So getting a bit of a different sound world with that one. Yeah, it's got a very jaunty sensibility behind that. Little atonal, some little clusters of effects, like sparkly sounds.
Yeah, and there's some kind of like, there's a sort of gloopiness to it as well that kind of puts you there with the aliens, because it's near the end of the game, this track.
Oh, okay. So it's, as you get like towards the climax of confronting the aliens, the ambient sounds kind of subside a little.
Yeah, there's a lot of travelling in this game as you sort of travel from country to country, and a lot of the music is sort of quite one or two note, just sort of ambient, sort of holding. And like reading reviews back, there's a lot of criticism that there's places where they'll just use mazes that recycle the same couple of screens.
Oh, okay.
Because of the age of it,
yeah,
it needs to kind of extend its runtime by recycling.
Right.
Which is probably why some of the music's cut down. But this is near the end, and you've got, you know, a bit more character to it then.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of character in this for a short sketch.
Yeah.
What's this I hear about a really severe copy protection system?
Yeah, this is one of the things that makes me think of it like a Sierra game, because the Sierra games were notorious for like, oh, you didn't pick up this one thing, or like you didn't press this button or open a window in chapter one. Well, now you're at chapter 20 and you're in a scene of like a hard block to progress.
Just intentionally wasting your time.
Yeah. After you play, but this one has one of the hard blocks of progress is a copy protection thing where because you're traveling around the world, you travel through airports and there are border checks, and when you travel to and from the United States, you have to enter a visa code which came in the booklet with the cassette or the disc.
Right. Yeah.
And if you enter that code wrong, if you enter it wrong five times, your character's put in jail.
like
on the screen in jail.
Yeah.
And there's a prison guard berating them. And then the prison guard will turn to the camera,
yeah,
and berate you, the player, saying they expected better of you. they thought, you know, you were an intelligent, kind person, and these developers have put so much work into their title, and you've done this. And it's a hard block to progress. It's not sort of like they do that, tell you off, and then move on.
That's it
until you can get a valid code, and when you enter a valid code, you can then leave jail.
Wow.
But otherwise, it's a solid like block to progression.
Yeah, that's one way of...
And I have a feeling that the code may have been like a CD key, and that there wasn't one code that everyone could just look up.
Right, I understand, yeah. So
I think it might have been...
But there's multi-character.
Like a password, yeah.
Yeah, like what you had to verify your legitimate copy of like Windows 98 or something,
yeah,
back in the day. Yeah.
Although this one hasn't been... It's a bit more obscure. It hasn't really hit the reissue trail the way the others have.
Oh, right.
Like, even Maniac Mansion's included on someone's PC in the re-release of Daily Tentacle.
The entire game.
Yeah. But, Zach McCracken sort of disappeared.
Ah. Well, maybe this time.
Yeah, I imagine you can find copies of it easy enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And even the ones that haven't been reissued, most of them are on Steam or GOG or...
Right, right.
They're tiny enough files, you can probably find them anywhere.
I think some of these games are available on like archive.org, you know, the Internet Archive.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's like just giving them away, really. All right, well, we're going to go back to Redbook Audio Land once more. And this is an interesting title. This is Grim Fandango, the remastered version, released in 2015. And I've got a few notes on this one. The soundtrack is by the composer Peter McConnell. And for this project, he was inspired by the early jazz and swing musicians Duke Ellington and Benny Goodman. In 1999, the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences Annual Interactive Achievement Awards, that's a long name, in those awards, this soundtrack was nominated in the category of Outstanding Achievement in Sound and Music. So again, we're having a LucasArts title with a lot of pedigree in the music and sound design stakes. And the remastered version, which we're going to hear a tune from shortly, the soundtrack was fully orchestrated through performances by the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. So
yeah, I mean,
that's something.
Yeah, all the reissues use the same score as the original.
Yeah.
But quite often they're just polished up, but this one they've really done it justice.
No doubt, yeah. So this must be a really special soundtrack then.
Yeah, like quite often with game soundtracks you can buy them as MP3s or whatever.
Right.
I'm pretty sure this one had a physical release.
Oh, okay,
like
okay.
You buy your movie soundtracks, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure this one, even originally, as well as now, there's a physical version of it too.
Like an audio CD rather than a bunch of MIDI files or something.
Yeah.
Wow, okay, this is the real thing we're going to hear. You suggested a couple of tracks for this one, and I've picked one of them out, and I believe it's called Casino Calavera.
I mean, the game's set in the sort of Mexican afterlife.
Ah, right, I see.
Everyone in it's a skeleton.
Ah, so it's like a sort of undead casino type thing.
Yeah.
Ah, that's cool. Nice. All right, well, with that image fresh in my mind, let's get into this. The remastered version of Grim Fandango, released 2015. Casino Calavera, composed by Peter McConnell. Very nice stuff there from Grim Fandango, the remastered version, and that was composed by Peter McConnell, Casino Calavera. There's some really tasty clarinet business going on in there, which is always very pleasing for me to hear. Like stuff that I do play clarinet a bit, but I could never hope to do that kind of lead line justice.
And but they've done it so well. Like, it doesn't, the whole thing's like a film noir.
Yeah.
And kind of has, it's told in kind of four chapters, and it's the second one, which people say is the best, is the one where you're running the nightclub and casino that this is from. But it doesn't sound like it's like a pastiche of kind of like, you know, like if there was an episode of a TV show where they're like, oh, we've gone back to the 20s, look what this is like.
Really
hokey. This feels like it belongs.
It sounds pretty for real to me.
Yeah,
definitely. It's got like the kind of the brisk pace, not just in the tempo, but also how it's arranged, how the different voices come in and out. It's present and correct. I can definitely get on board with those purported influences, Ellington and Goodman. There's a vague swing thing happening in that.
Yeah. In like other parts, Goodman, you can hear the sort of the swing sound to it. You can imagine it coming along. Like, if that played alongside, like, Sing, 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 you wouldn't...
Okay.
You wouldn't think one of these is 50 years apart from the other.
Yeah, right. So I can understand how this the soundtrack got its plaudits. If what you would... I really hate using the word, but it's a question of authenticity, I suppose.
Yeah.
If that was one of their criteria, then I would imagine that that was... satisfied quite amply there.
Well, they say the influences are stuff like Casablanca as well as old gangster films.
Okay.
So it's all kind of in there.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of how this game looks, like graphics wise, does it work quite nicely with the music?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everyone's sort of there in sort of, you know, sharp suits, you know, moody lighting.
Yeah.
Your sort of private detective style, you know, the office door, you know, the glass panel with the writing in it.
Okay.
Kind of look, you know, lots of moody shadows. I mean, but they are all skeletons in that sort of Mexican Day of the Dead kind of sugar skull.
Yeah, right,
sort of way.
Like the ubiquitous Halloween costumes these days.
Yeah. Well, because the story is told in the sort of the afterlife, and there's like a sort of 4-year purgatory where you have to work your work to get to the next place.
I see.
And your characters are sort of trapped there, and for some reason the purgatory takes the form of a film noir with a sort of core story of a property deal being corrupted and an insurance salesman who sells train tickets to them. They can skip you ahead of some time in purgatory.
Nice. Ah, smart. Okay, well, puzzle-wise, is this one something that I could maybe get
this,
behind?
Yeah, this is... The later ones, it's a trend in kind of adventure games in general, I think, that they get less obtuse and more story-driven. I guess maybe it's the confidence to say we don't need to justify gaminess. And like now, I hate the term, but you get games that people call walking simulators, which are more kind of like interactive stories.
Right.
Like the people who use walking sim, they're using it really derogatory, even though these are actually some really good games.
Yeah, I got you.
Stuff like Everybody's Gone to the Rapture or What Became of Edith Finch, like that kind of thing. But even normal adventure games, stuff like Oxenfree, now tend to be more character-driven,
right,
story-based.
And the music's going to play a part in that.
Yeah, and Grim Fandango, like, for saying these things are sort of rich in character, like these LucasArts games, like each one's so distinctive.
Yeah.
Even though they're all the... Well, this one is the one that isn't the Scum Engine. But it's still a LucasArts game. It has the humour, it has the references. It has, you know, the strength in it. Just it's how it looks and feels. Like, it's so complete.
Yeah, nice. I'll check this one out, I think. Remastered version or original version? What do you think?
Well...
You know me.
I mean, the remasters would probably be more expensive. But the remasters all have the option... And it's cool on the console because it's a single button press.
Ah, to switch.
To switch back.
Yeah.
And the difference isn't as big in Grim Fandango as it is in the others.
Okay.
Because it tends to be, because it's got that kind of early 3D look and all the characters are quite boxy. So
nice.
Really it just sort of, you know, draws a sort of the straighter lines around the characters rather than, you know, having fully redrawn artwork.
Yeah.
But the audio switches.
Oh, okay.
Same as with the others.
That's handy.
Yeah, it's, of the ones we've got today, probably the most story-driven and the least likely to say, you know, you need to charge your battery. Now here's some...
Yeah.
Take this for wanted sign and trick. Who was it? Trick Benjamin Franklin into using a lab coat for a kite that has your battery in its pocket.
Oh, no. Too scary for me. No way. Right, we're gonna go for something completely different next, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, what we got now?
When I say these things remind... When I say LucasArts games remind me of kind of classic Nickelodeon, classic Cartoon Network kind of things, these guys did actually get themselves a cartoon off the back of the game.
Ah.
And it was cancelled for being too obtuse and weird, even for them. Even for cartoons. I mean, in a world of Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah, I was going to say, how is it weird with Ren and Stimpy?
It's... Or, like, what else was around then? The Tick, that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is pretty wild
stuff. I think if it came out now, it would probably be a cartoon that was just aired for adults, even though it isn't rude or...
Adult Swim, right.
Yeah. But this is Sam and Max.
Sam and Max. Sam and Max Hit the Road.
Yeah.
All right.
I was going to say Freelance Police, but that's the name of the cartoon.
Right, okay.
Because that's their job. They are the Freelance Police.
Ah.
A big old hound dog who's a sort of been there and seen it all detective.
Yeah.
And a cartoon rabbit who's nearly all made of teeth and mad sort of bonkers energy.
Okay, I can see how that would be a good double act.
Who, in this game, go on a road trip across America, sideshows, freak shows, carnivals, you know, all that, urban legends.
All that.
And this is one of those games where it kind of goes, all of those things are true and they're all happening at once.
Right, okay, I see. So, in a PC game.
Yeah.
Tremendous. 1993. It was a very good year. 1993, Sam and Max Hit the Road, and we have Carnival of the Odd is the track.
Yeah, this is one of the earlier stops on the road trip, but it pretty much... You know, this is the kind of game where there's a woman who has the neck of a giraffe, and that's one of her... That's why she's there. There's a thing where you're chasing the Yeti. You know, there's a bit where you have to put on VR helmets, and all the graphics start looking like... Do you remember Another World?
Ooh.
Kind of Amiga, late Amiga title.
That rings a bell, but I can't say I remember.
I have a feeling the sequel was Fade to Black on the PS1.
Ah, okay.
But basically the whole thing changes. It's like, you're like kind of like vectored, kind of rotoscope kind of graphics.
Mm-hmm.
The whole game changes to that for a bit because you're trapped in a VR machine.
That's ridiculous.
There's a guy who's kind of like an Elvis... but who hunts animals and sings a really long song about how he's going to hunt and kill all the animals.
Okay, in an Elvis voice.
Yeah, there's bottomless pits, there's... If you can think of anything that would have been in one of those kind of generation of cartoons...
Yeah.
Or Tales of the Unexpected or anything kind of like that, it's all in this game.
Oh, wow.
It's super dense for that kind of stuff all being packed in.
Ah, great. Okay, well, let's check out this tune then. Carnival of the Odd, and it is composed by Clint Bohakian, Michael Land, and Peter McConnell.
Thank you.
Carnival of the Odd from Sam and Max Hit the Road, released in 93 for the PC. And that one started like another vaguely jazzy kind of affair, but then it went into this sound where it sounds like it's taunting you.
Yeah, because in these games you'll spend, in theory, you should be passing through a lot of the environments quite quickly.
Mm.
And this is true of all of them, but backtracking and sort of, so you quite often, you'd hear that start a lot.
Yeah.
So you'd come in, you'd pass through, say, the carnival tent, and it's got that intro. And then after about 35 minutes, when you still haven't worked out what items to combine or who gets given what or
yeah.
how anything, you know, interacts, that's when that second loop
yeah, right, so that
just comes and comes. Like, we haven't had a lot of those tracks that we've played, but all of these games have these tracks that'll just keep looping as you mm-hmm. are just stuck, wandering around, scratching your head, clicking, going through your inventory, selecting each item and clicking it on everything in the room until eventually one of them does something.
Oh, video games are so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't like, especially once the fully voiced games come out, video game characters saying, that doesn't seem quite right, or, no, I'm not doing that. You know, those
yeah.
But it happened, you know, every single click, and you're like, no, I meant to click, push, not pull, stop saying that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're just...
In the background, there's that,
and that music's just keep going. But then, that is the character of Max as well. They'll taunt you if you get puzzles wrong as well.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's in the character of that one more than anything else to just sort of keep you on your toes. And yeah, well, like I say, like those cartoons would, you know, they'd break the fourth wall.
Yeah, like look at the screen and go, hey,
yeah, like I said, Animaniacs, like Max is the Animaniacs.
Okay.
In a single character.
I see. And I suppose there'll be plenty of like secondary characters in the Animaniacs that Sam could have been.
Yeah,
like a sort equivalent
of
world
weary, just watching this thing go on.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like some kind of a like stooge, maybe sometimes.
Yeah,
yeah, nice. Animaniacs, you got me. You're taking me back with that one. I haven't seen that in a very long time, but that was a good cartoon.
Yeah, and it probably says something that Sam and Max was originally. A strip one of the designers made for his college newspaper.
Oh, really?
And then when LucasArts were between titles and they were all pitching ideas, he pitched Sam and Max. It got picked up as a game, turned into a cartoon. The comics were either republished or started up again. And then one of the successors... This one hasn't been reissued, but you can buy the original.
Yeah.
Still, in plenty of places. But one of the successor companies... to LucasArts, the developers went off and made their own. Mm. Like, the sort of key names for sort of game development at LucasArts were Ron Gilbert, Tim Schafer, and Dave Grossman.
Right, right.
And they went off and formed a few different studios, but one of them's Telltale Games.
That's familiar.
Do you remember watching me play The Walking Dead?
And
it was really upsetting.
Oh, that was a great game, though.
That... is one of the successor titles to this.
That's a Telltale, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably why I've heard of them.
There's two Telltale Sam and Max games because part of the team from LucasArts became Telltale.
Ah,
and
nice.
And later, sure, they've... So like I say, they've specialised in doing like more story-based games. And Telltale in particular in making really sad games or games that are just brutal.
Oh, it was bleak as hell.
In bleak story. They made the Minecraft story game, and it's exactly the same as the same mechanics, like same game engine as The Walking Dead. And they managed to put in a brutal, unavoidable death in that.
This is Minecraft.
That has a really weird, bleak streak of humour to it that kind of goes, oh yeah, there's still some LucasArts in there.
Yeah, right. So not afraid to...
I feel like I should spoil it because it's so in keeping. But then I don't know who's playing Minecraft story mode.
Well, yeah. How about you just tell us, and if people don't want to know, they can fast forward like 1.5 minutes.
Yeah, you've got the main character has a sidekick that's a pig that sort of oinks and pulls faces like Gromit from Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah.
And they go on this big quest across dimensions. They're building things. There's a mystical building artifact that they're after.
Okay,
to
yeah.
To stop a sort of evil force destroying the Minecraft world. And in the final battle, they're inside the monster trying to like stop, you know, there's like an item they need to trigger inside it, and that'll save them. And when it does, it explodes. And the pig sidekick is lost in the explosion.
Oh, no.
There's a bit where you're trying to reach it with your arm, and it's kind of like, no, I can't reach you. And then the explosion happens. And then you see him lying on the ground, twitching, and kind of doing really sad, whimpering noises. And the characters all run over, like, going, no, this is... And then, in Minecraft, in the Minecraft proper,
the normal
when
game.
Characters or creatures die, they do item drops.
Yeah.
And because the story... For all it has a story and the gameplay isn't the same, it keeps the basics of Minecraft right.
Right.
So the pig dies, there's a puff of smoke, and then there's like a spinning item drop of ham.
Yeah, I was going to say it's going to be bacon or something, isn't it? Yeah.
So these characters are all crying, and then he just goes, and ham. There's the item drop. And it's kind of like going, this is really sad, but also...
That's ridiculous. That's really funny.
Yeah, it's really... I mean, I don't know what happened to... Because obviously the Minecraft audience is quite young.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know how it goes over with them. Like, if you're into YouTube reacting video, there's a lot of people crying down their webcams.
Yeah, that's so funny.
And I think that kind of goes...
That's LucasArts right there.
Yeah,
though,
and you're like, yeah, I can... That pulls it back to Sam and Max and Tentacle and...
Right, I got you.
The rest.
That's kind of nice that kind of legacy is still finding its way into new games,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and then there's another company, Double Fine, who made Psychonauts on the PS2 as a sort of cult classic.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who are doing the reissues. But they've also done a game called Thimbleweed Park.
Ah, yes.
Which is basically the old team of kind of Tim Schafer and Ron Gilbert and the rest getting back together and creating a sort of Twin Peaks, X-Files, kind of Welcome to Night Vale style sort of murder mystery game.
Yeah, right.
Using something that looks exactly like the Scum Engine. And they haven't sort of gone, oh, in our later titles we had better graphics. They've just gone, let's make an 8-bit title.
Ah, right.
Or kind of maybe 16.
So something intentionally, like a nostalgic
sort of,
type
thing. Yeah, just a deliberate kind of, the reissues look new and they work on new systems. This works on new systems, but it's all the old gameplay.
Yeah, like how you remember it.
Yeah.
That's just smart. I mean, there's plenty of that in like action games, so I guess it figures that they would do it with adventure games too.
It's just nice that it's kind of the old team.
Yeah. Getting the band back together.
Yeah, basically.
That's cool. That's nice to hear about. Yeah, right. So, it just goes to show there's still, like, a lot of folk really, really love these games. Perhaps I could become one of them yet. Maybe I could ease myself into the genre somehow. Full Throttle seems like the way in, maybe.
I mean, for all that I've been playing games since junior school or younger.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of 32, 33 by the time these click with me.
I see. Okay, well, I'm approaching those years, so... Yeah, alright, these soundtracks are, from what I've heard of them, are really, really sharp as well. So I do appreciate you putting these under my nose. Quite varied too, like you said, there's a lot of variation. No two games look the same, and I guess no two games sound the same, from what I can tell.
Yeah, that's the strength. That's the strength they have over Sierra, beyond anything else.
Right.
Or probably the reason that they were able to last and make a big success in the PC era, whereas Sierra's main successes were, or in this genre were, you know, sort of pre-Windows, is probably that they were just so good at character and, like, creating worlds so completely.
Mm.
And music's that, and the look's that, and everything, you know. They're just total packages.
Yeah, nice. Like, really, really thoroughly realised artistic visions or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. All right, well, I think we're just about done. We have one more track up our sleeves, but before we get into that, I'll do the usual talking at the end of episodes. If you want to get in touch and say hello for whatever reason, let me know what... maybe you want to let me know that you enjoyed a particular episode, or if you have any ideas for episodes even, I'm all ears. You can email me at foreversoundversion@gmail.com. You can like this podcast on Facebook at facebook.com/foreversoundversion, and you can follow this podcast on Twitter through the handle fsvpodcast. Anything you want to plug?
I mean, if you're in the Newcastle area, the Lytton Phil has a great exhibition of all the stuff that, because it, you know, that they had when they were a private museum in the, you know, 1800s.
Oh yeah,
that's quite cool. And
Lytton Phil,
not that long ago, I did an event called Bright Club, where people try and be entertaining about their PhDs or university research or anything like that.
Mm.
I don't know if it's on the internet yet, but the Centre for Life might put that on their YouTube.
I hope so.
So I'm sure I'll put that online somewhere if they ever upload it.
Cool. And Twitter-wise, is it still Rob Obviously?
Yep, Rob Obviously.
Rob Obviously for Robert Hunter here. Yeah, that was a cool thing, the Bright Club. So yeah, I'll keep my eyes peeled for that as well. All right, closing us out then, we have one more track from one more soundtrack, and I believe there's a Spielberg connection.
Yeah. I kept the whole rest of the list is kind of down to the sort of core creators, the sort of main developers who people at LucasArts games, and I've sort of skipped over a couple and some of the sequels, but this one was devised by George Lucas's good friend Steven Spielberg.
Mm.
Originally as a movie, then I think as television, and then as three different games, until eventually it became The Dig.
The Dig.
An adventure game. Quite a late one for being a Scum Engine game.
Mm-hmm.
But it was weird. Like, the reviews kind of go, it's big and it's ambitious, you know, and it's cinematic.
Right.
But also dated, because it's using
the Scum Engine
when things like Grim Fandango are already in production.
Mm. But nevertheless, it's pretty well received, though.
Yeah, story-wise, there's an asteroid coming towards Earth, and a team is sent up there to get, you know, take care of it.
Yeah,
like it, you know, Armageddon, Deep Impact.
Those movies. I mean, this game came out in 1995, so it's floating around the time that's the disaster movie.
Yeah, if it wasn't a Steven Spielberg film, it would have been, you know, like Independence Day,
right,
kind of movie, Armageddon, that kind of thing.
Definitely.
Although once they get there, they discover the alien, like something sort of more transcendent and alien. Like, if anyone remembers a film called The Abyss.
I remember The Abyss.
The James Cameron film from the 80s. It's sort of, somewhere between Armageddon and The Abyss. But it's definitely got, compared to all the others, having their sort of in-jokes and quirks, this one plays it pretty straight.
Yeah, it's a bit more sober, right?
Yeah, and having the hands of someone like Spielberg on it, you know, they've definitely made sure it stays cinematic.
I got you,
you know, keeps the scale up.
Yeah, right. So, soundtrack-wise, what kind of thing are we getting? Is that also like some kind of orchestral cinematic type thing?
Yeah, like there's a lot of sort of, you know, John Williams-y touches,
right?
That kind of thing throughout the score. Lots of kind of big reveal sort of moments where the music crescendos into, you know, oh, we're opening the portal. Swells of music and strings.
Right. Well, we're gonna have to my ears a particularly cinematic moment called The Monument, composed by Michael Land. So let's get into that one. Thanks a lot for coming out, Rob. On this, we should probably be outside, but we're not. So thanks for taking some time out your evening to sit inside with me and talk about LucasArts games.
No problem. Yeah, this is the kind of weather where you're either outside in shorts or inside, curtains closed in front of the computer.
Yeah, well, I'm inside in shorts, so I'm trying to have my cake and eat it. But I think we've covered a lot of ground here, some great tunes, so... Yeah, thanks again. We'll have you on again before too long.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
We'll figure something out. I'm sure there's an abundance of ideas we have for episodes. All right, thanks for listening, everyone. All the best for now.